Let's be honest. In some circles, marketing has a bad reputation. I have a friend, a scientist friend, who delights in reminding me, only half jokingly, that all my chosen profession does is train business people in the telling of lies. The better I do my job as a marketing professor, the better, the more artful, the more deceptive the lies my students will be able to tell. Marketing, according to this view, is all about tricking people into buying something they otherwise wouldn't buy. From my friend's perspective, products and services should speak for themselves. People should choose what to buy based on the merits, not based on persuasive appeals. We might call my friend's perspective the better mousetrap philosophy of business. According to this view, companies just innovate. Then consumers evaluate the various offerings, and then they beat a path to the door of the firm that develops the best mousetrap. No puffery, no spin, no withholding of information. That's the way the world should work. And the only thing keeping us from this glorious business utopia is the deviousness of those duplicitous marketers who obscure and obfuscate. As you might expect, this better mousetrap theory of business is not a point of view that I endorse. In fact, I'm going to argue that the better mousetrap narrative more often than not gets things exactly backward. In my opinion, it is far more common for great products to fail, not because of deceptions or incomplete information, but because the marketers who are supposed to be championing this great product fail to communicate the true value of their own offering. In this lecture, we are going to talk about positioning, which is the process of determining which aspects of the offering are most important in creating value for the customer, and then clearly communicating that value. In discussing positioning, I will be sharing several examples that explicitly violate the better mousetrap theory. The sad reality is companies frequently develop products and services that are objectively better than the competition in some way, but fail to gain any traction in the marketplace. And very often, these marketplace failures are actually positioning failures. With that in mind, let's look at the positioning process. It involves two steps and then two checks. First, we start by developing an offering's value proposition. Second, we select one or two key benefits that anchor the positioning. Now we have two checks to ensure that our positioning is achieving its objectives. The first check, does it create value for our target customer? The second check, does it differentiate our offering from the competition? Let's walk through this process in greater detail, starting with the value proposition. The value proposition is an objective assessment of all the benefits of buying, owning, and consuming a product or service from the customer's perspective. For example, imagine you work for Volvo. To keep this example simple, let's imagine you work for Volvo in the 1980s. The value proposition for Volvos in the 1980s would include a lot of benefits. It was a European import at a time when imports, especially those from Europe, had a lot of image advantages over domestic brands. It was a high-performance luxury car. It was comfortable. It was safe. It was reliable. The laundry list of benefits constitutes the value proposition. If we lived in a better mousetrap world, we would simply communicate all this information to the customer and let them decide. This approach would seem to make a lot of sense. After all, telling a customer that a car is luxurious and safe and reliable and exclusive should be more persuasive than telling them about just one of those attributes. But if you know anything about Volvo, you already know the punchline to this story. Volvo didn't throw the kitchen sink at its potential customers when telling them about its cars. They successfully implemented the second step in positioning, which is to take the value proposition and then choose just one key benefit to communicate to their customers. In Volvo's case, it was safety. It's not that the other benefits in Volvo's value proposition were somehow hidden. It's not as if customers who are interested in buying a Volvo wouldn't be able to find out all those other great things about Volvos. But when communicating to customers, especially in advertising, the main message delivered over and over is that Volvo makes safe cars. Ads from the 1980s showed Volvos being joyously rammed by other cars or dropped from great heights in crash tests. They featured people giving moving testimonials about how they believed Volvo had saved their lives. They hammered home this message that Volvo makes safe cars. Volvo was so successful in establishing this link between their brand and the safety attribute that it continues to this day. If you ask someone to name a safe car brand, they're very likely to say Volvo. But here's the interesting thing. Volvo no longer makes the safest cars on the road. At one time they did, but now, because of government mandates and improving technology, most new cars on the market are very safe. Now, I'm not claiming that Volvos are not safe. They are. It's just that they're not safer than other car brands anymore. To give you some idea, every year the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety publishes a list of cars with top safety ratings. One recent year, there were 115 cars on the list, and only four of them were Volvos. Just four out of more than 100. What did Volvo do that made such an enduring impression in the minds of consumers? They took that second step of positioning. They kept it simple. Instead of overwhelming customers with all the things that make Volvo great, they positioned their brand on the strongest attribute they had and created something their customers could understand and remember. The results were powerful and enduring. Let's contrast that with a more recent example, the launch of TiVo. TiVo was the first to market with a digital video recorder, or DVR, and they should have enjoyed a huge first-mover advantage. They introduced a radical technology that would fundamentally change the way people watch TV. And their market research suggested the device was destined to be a smashing success. In initial tests, consumers' reactions were simply off the charts. The market research firms they had hired to do the testing said they had never seen a product that tested better. Never. The stage was set for an enormously successful launch. Now there was just the question of how to position it. The use of DVRs has become so ubiquitous that it may be tough to remember just what a breakthrough this technology was when it was first introduced. The value proposition for TiVo included such radically new benefits as the ability to pause live TV, the ability to watch something at another time from when it was first broadcast. You could schedule the recording of an entire season of a particular show. You could skip ads. You could get advice from the computer on other shows you might enjoy. The lesson we learned from Volvo is that TiVo should have taken that long list of benefits and picked the one they thought was most likely to resonate with their target customer. That would make a strong position. That's not what TiVo did. Instead of picking a simple message and communicating it clearly, TiVo opted to throw everything at the consumers all at once. The ads that TiVo ran highlighted all of its potential benefits. They had ads extolling the virtues of pausing live TV. They had others showing the advantages of skipping commercials. Others explaining that customers could create their own customized playlists, and so on. Essentially, the message was, TiVo can do everything. And how did that work out for them? Well, despite being the first to market with a product that people absolutely loved, despite having glowing expert reviews, despite a very expensive national advertising campaign, 14 months after launch, they were only up to 42,000 subscribers, just a tiny fraction of where they thought they would be. And before long, competition swept in. As of 2012, they had captured less than 5% of the DVR market. Being the first to build a better mousetrap was not enough for TiVo. They eventually were able to explain this complex message, detailing all the ways its product could change your relationship with TV. They eventually succeeded in educating consumers on the many virtues of a DVR. Eventually, TiVo was so successful in communicating this message that TiVo became a verb. Unfortunately for TiVo the company, by the time people were TiVoing things, they were probably doing it on a non-TiVo DVR. Essentially, TiVo had engaged in a very expensive education campaign to teach someone else's customers about the virtues of DVRs. Remember that your value proposition is not your positioning. Don't tell your customer everything that is great about your offering. Keep it simple. Very rarely are consumers sufficiently motivated to process and understand complex messages. When consumers don't appreciate just how great your offering is, simply giving them more information is not the solution. Now that we have positioned our offering, we need to perform our two checks to ensure that our positioning will meet our objectives. First, does the positioning make it clear what value is being provided to the target customer? And second, does the positioning make it clear how the offering is different from and better than competing offerings? First, we have to make sure we are providing value to the target customer. One way of thinking about positioning is just as the flip side of targeting. After all, you can't hope to successfully position an offering until you know for whom you are trying to position it. A given benefit will not create value for everyone. Some people just aren't interested in safe cars, for example. Which is not to say that anyone wants an unsafe car, of course, but positioning your car around a benefit of safety will only work if your target is a group of customers for whom safety is the primary driver of their automobile purchase. Parents of young children, for example. Exactly the same benefit would be shrugged off as irrelevant if you were targeting a different group, say college-aged males. So when choosing the one benefit you want to position on, look at your target customers. What is it that they value most? How are they making their decisions? Let's imagine you have been hired by a large American city to implement a bike sharing program. These schemes typically work by allowing people to borrow or rent a bike from one location, use it for a while, then you deposit it at another location. They've been very successful in some cities, particularly in Europe. Now, if you were to design a program like this, you would need to make a number of decisions. Where would you place the terminals? How much would you charge to rent a bike? What kinds of bikes would you use? In short, how would you position your new bike sharing program? A good way to start would be to recognize that different groups of people would want different things in a bike sharing program. So it's important to figure out the different potential targets for your program. A list of potential users might include commuters, people running errands, exercisers, maybe tourists. Now, let's think about what those different groups value. All these groups value convenience, but each of these groups will find different locations convenient. For commuters, convenience means locations close to both home and work. Errand runners, in contrast, would like spots near shopping hubs. Tourists would need locations near hotels and tourist attractions. And exercisers might like locations near parks and trails. Now, what about the type of bike? Exercisers would probably prefer something sturdy, able to handle different types of terrain. Commuters and errand runners would like something with large baskets, something that can carry briefcases and grocery bags. Tourists might like something light and easy to use, maybe a fixed wheel design or something with just a few gears. We could go on. I have two points that I'm trying to make with this example. The first is that positioning is about more than just deciding what to put in your ads. Every decision you make about the product or service affects the value proposition and thus the options you have for positioning your offering. The second point I'm trying to make is that without knowing who your target is, or in this case, who your targets are, it's simply impossible to position your offering coherently. The dozens of decisions you make in terms of what benefits to offer could either be creating or destroying value for your customer. It depends on who your customer is. As it happens, in the summer of 2008, Washington, D.C. launched a bike sharing program called Smart Bike DC. And they were very optimistic. Things didn't go well. The first decision they made was where to place the limited number of bike terminals they had allocated money for. They decided, for some reason, to place all of the terminals adjacent to metro stations. This allocation scheme did not make it particularly convenient for any of their target groups. Muters, errand runners, exercisers, tourists, any of them couldn't use the bikes easily. It also meant that wherever it was possible to go using a smart bike, it was already possible to go quickly and cheaply using the subway. They also chose a bike design that did not appear to create value for any particular group. These bikes, described by one journalist as commie three speeds, were ugly, distinctively, perhaps embarrassingly so. But even worse than the aesthetics was the lack of practicality. The bikes came with a flimsy wire basket attached to the front, but the rack wasn't designed to be used for running errands. In fact, the terms of use explicitly forbade users from putting anything heavy in the basket. Thanks a lot. The design of the bikes, with small tires and small seats and upright handlebars and only three gears, also made them unlikely candidates for exercisers interested in using a bike to get a good workout. Other policies mandated that the bikes could only be checked out for 3 hours at a time. Sorry, tourists, you're out of luck. They could also not be checked out before sunrise or returned later than sunset. Riders were also forbidden from taking the bikes out of the city, so sorry, commuters. Finally, the only way to access a bike was to apply for an annual pass, which made it impractical for anyone coming in from out of town. In short, Smart Bike systematically positioned their offering in a way to not create value for any particular group of customers who might possibly have had any reason for using the bikes. Smart Bike DC suffered a quick, though entirely predictable, death. 2 years after launch, Smart Bike was averaging less than one rider per bike per day. Out of the millions of people living and working in DC, only 1,700 ever signed up for the service. And of those who subscribed, many never even bothered to use a Smart Bike even once. But this story has a happy ending. In 2010, the city used what it had learned from the failure of Smart Bike, and they launched Capital Bike Share. This new program used a cheaper terminal design, which allowed them to install more docking stations than they could afford using the Smart Bike model. They also wisely chose to place the stations in locations that large numbers of people work, live, shop, and visit. With just the swipe of a credit card, bikes can be rented by the half hour, with the first half hour free. Errand runners and tourists, you may rejoice now. For a discounted rate, you could also buy daily or monthly passes, and you could purchase them at the rack or online. The bikes were larger and more substantial than Smart Bikes, with a larger basket and more friendly hours of operation. Finally, DC worked with Arlington, Virginia, and surrounding communities to develop an integrated system, which meant it was actually possible for those who lived in the suburbs and worked in the city to get out of their cars and bike to work. The program has been a smashing success. In its first 2 years, it had enrolled almost 27,000 subscribers and sold almost 200,000 day passes. Soon, Capital Bike Share riders were averaging more than 1 million trips per year. I like this example because it shows that good marketing is not just about selling soap or cars or soda. Positioning can make or break a government program, a public health initiative, or a nonprofit scheme. The lesson is to always know who your customer is when you position your offering and make every decision with an eye toward creating value for that customer. So, we've seen the importance of the first check of positioning. Make sure you are creating value for your target customer. Now, let's turn to our second check, making sure that you differentiate your offering from the competition. An important part of positioning a product is giving customers points of parity with other offerings, telling people what your product is like, as well as defining points of differentiation, telling people what your offering is doing that is different from and superior to other offerings. Let me illustrate this using advertising from the men's shower gel category. I'll walk you through the ads, created to promote several different brands in the category, and you'll be able to see the different positioning strategies, the points of parity and points of differentiation used by each brand. One of the first competitors in the men's shower gel space was Unilever's Axe brand. In one of the early commercials introducing the product, a young man is finishing up his shower at what appears to be his girlfriend's apartment. He places the bar of pink soap back in the soap dish, and music starts up. Sounds like something you might hear in a Disney movie. Greeting the confused man as he steps out of the shower is a menagerie of helpful woodland creatures who bring him his towel and then start forcefully trying to dress him up in women's clothing, makeup and a tiara. As he tries to fight off these animals, the tagline appears on the screen. If you use a woman's soap, you'll smell like one. In positioning its shower gel, Axe chose its competition, bar soaps, and in particular, women's bar soaps. Just like whatever soap your girlfriend or wife has chosen, Axe shower gel will also get you clean. It then defined its points of differentiation relative to this competition, a masculine scent. Contrast Axe's positioning with Nivea's. Nivea for Men launched its body wash with a commercial it called Not for Kids. The ad is set in a high school. It features short interviews with high school students who are holding the Nivea body wash and giving their opinions of the product. Nivea for Men body wash, huh? Dude, who uses a body wash to get clean? A boy wearing football pads tells us, if babes can't smell it from here, I'm not interested. And the name needs to dominate. I dominate. A third sniffs the bottle and then complains, this won't increase my ability to mate. The scene then shifts to a young professional in a suit, walking toward his luxury car. He sniffs the Nivea bottle and asks, won't dry out my skin? Doesn't reek? Isn't that the point? The ad ends with the tagline, body wash for grown-ups. Nivea chose its competition, Axe. Its points of parity are that it's a body wash specifically formulated for men, just like Axe. But unlike Axe, it doesn't have the overpowering musk of desperation that has come to be associated with awkward junior high school boys the world over. Dove Men Plus Care is the next ad we'll be examining. This ad features clips of men showering set to the Lone Ranger part of the William Tell Overture. As these men lather up, a voiceover informs us that Dove Men Plus Care has micro-moisture, which is, quote, clinically proven to fight skin dryness better than any regular men's body wash. Dove, positioned against the men's body wash category, emphasizing that it works like other body washes in terms of getting you clean, but unlike other body washes, it was better at fighting dryness. Remember when Nivea casually claimed that it won't dry out your skin? Well, Dove is better than Nivea on that front. Clinically proven, in fact. That is its point of differentiation. Next, let's move on to Gillette. You had no idea there was so much going on in the men's body wash category, did you? Gillette's ad shows a man in the shower. On the shower floor at his feet are two bottles of body wash. One bottle looks an awful lot like Dove's Men Plus Care. The other bottle is Gillette, which is the one the man ultimately chooses. As we see the suds flow down the drain, a football drops to the floor around the man's feet. Then come power tools, gardening implements, even a lobster trap, all crashing down to the shower floor. The announcer tells us that Gillette's odor shield targets and neutralizes odors, which is necessary because, quote, you've got a man-size odor hanging all over you. Gillette has pretty clearly chosen its competition, Dove. And how is Gillette's men's body wash different from and better than Dove's? In its ability to fight odor. There are two things I want you to get out of this exercise. The first is I want you to recognize just how much variety there is in terms of opportunities to position your offering. I picked just one relatively mundane category, men's body wash. Objectively, this is a very simple product. And yet, we can see that these different brands each chose unique attributes to position on, and they each chose a slightly different competitor or set of competitors against which to make their comparisons. They defined their competition, and then they communicated the one way in which they were better than the competition. But there's something else I want you to get out of this example. Imagine for a moment that the set of ads I just described represents all of the men's body washes out on the market. Assuming that's true, if you had taken a position as a new brand manager in this category, and you were asked to reposition an existing brand or to launch a new brand, do you see any opportunities here? Is there any conceptual space open to being exploited? One interesting thing about the men's body wash category, at least in the several years after it was created, is that nearly all the brands were positioned against other men's body washes. All of the ads I told you about, with the exception of the Axe ad I mentioned first, they all explicitly mentioned that their body wash was better than other body washes. And even the Axe ad was very narrowly positioned relative to women's soaps, not bar soaps in general. Now, I don't know the exact numbers, but I can only imagine that the vast majority of men still use bar soaps when showering, and only a small minority have switched over to liquid body washes. And yet, no one is positioning relative to soaps. No one is trying to convince men that their body wash is different from and better than the bar soap that they use. I've actually been tracking this category for several years now, and it is still shocking to me that these brands all position relative to this narrow category of body wash, fighting for scraps of this relatively small pie, when the larger bar soap category seems to hold so much opportunity for growth. So, that's the second lesson from this extended example. Think broadly when choosing your competition. If you're having trouble coming up with compelling reasons why your offering is different from and better than the competition, it might be that you just need to improve your offering. Sometimes that's the only solution. But it's also possible that you could benefit from choosing a different set of competitors, maybe even a different category altogether. Remember, your competition was not handed down to you from Olympus. Competition is in the eye of the customer, and in many cases, you can influence which firms or brands or offerings your customer considers substitutes for your product or service. Picking your competition is an important part of competing in the marketplace. Choose wisely. Now that we've identified several principles of positioning, let's add another tool to our marketing toolbox. One good way to articulate your positioning strategy is to craft a positioning statement. A positioning statement is a single sentence that encapsulates everything that's important about the offering's position in the marketplace. Positioning statements are not taglines or slogans. They are primarily for internal consumption, for keeping the entire marketing department, and ideally the entire company, focused and on message. Positioning statements include several important pieces of information. First, they should include a brief description of the target customer. Second, they should refer to the brands or product category that serve as the competition. This establishes the points of parity. Finally, a positioning statement should clearly and concisely articulate the primary benefit, the point of differentiation, that this offering presents to the customer relative to the competition. For example, a positioning statement for Nivea's body wash might be, Nivea for men is the best choice for men who want a body wash to clean and moisturize their skin, but who don't want to smell like a teenage boy on his way to prom. So, today we've discussed the key components of positioning. Two steps, two checks, and a strong statement to keep the company focused. This actually sets up a new stage in our course. Now that we've mastered segmentation, targeting, and positioning, we have all the tools we need to answer those three important marketing questions. Who is my customer? What do they value? And how can we give them what they value better than the competition? In our next lecture, we'll talk about how the answers to these questions can help you grow and increase sales.
This lecture is titled, Identifying Sources of Sales Growth.
In 1957, a mathematician and business strategist named Igor Ansoff published an article in the Harvard Business Review about the potential sources of sales growth. The focus of his article was on diversification, a topic that we'll cover in today's lecture. Almost as an aside, Ansoff proposed a framework for classifying different opportunities for sales growth. This 2x2 matrix, discussed in just a few paragraphs in an article that was primarily about something else, is, in my opinion, one of the most powerful ideas in marketing. When I teach the Ansoff matrix in my MBA classes, it's remarkable. Everyone grabs a pencil and starts writing. Students had been dozing off a few minutes earlier or suddenly sitting upright in their chairs and asking me to speak slower and to repeat myself. So, are you ready to hear what it is? Have I played this up enough for you? Okay. The Ansoff matrix is a very simple chart. On the left side, we have customers, grouped into two categories. Current customers, those who are already buying our products, and new customers, who are not currently buying from us, but who could potentially be convinced to do so. Across the top of the chart, we have two classes of offerings. Our current offerings, those that we're currently selling, and new offerings, those that we're not yet selling, but we could. The intersection of the customer types and the offerings creates four boxes that categorize opportunities for sales growth. In the upper left-hand corner of the matrix is a situation where the business is selling its current customers more of its current offerings. This is known as market penetration. To the right of this box is a situation where you have a business that develops new products to sell to its current customer base. This is known as product development. In the lower left-hand corner is a situation where businesses sell existing products to a new group of customers. This is known as market development. And finally, in the lower right corner is a situation where the business sells new product lines to new groups of customers. This is known as diversification. The Ansoff matrix is a powerful tool to use when trying to figure out new ways to grow your business. For this reason, we are going to put the Ansoff matrix in our marketing toolbox. Let's start off in the upper left-hand quadrant of the matrix and talk about market penetration. This is a situation where you sell more of your current product line to your current customers. This is typically the least risky means of increasing sales, and also, surprisingly, the avenue for growth that is most often overlooked by marketers who want to increase sales. Selling a little more to people who have already indicated they like your offering, at least enough to have bought it once already, that's usually the low-hanging fruit, and it should usually be the place that you look to first for opportunities to increase sales. So, how do you get your current customers to buy more of your offerings? There are several strategies. One is to create additional occasions for them to use the product or service. Levi's Dockers brand used this strategy to grow their brand in the early 1990s. Business attire has gotten remarkably less formal over the last few decades. This is a cultural shift toward a more relaxed work culture, and it had many causes. But one significant marker of this change was the explosive growth of casual Fridays at offices across the country. Now, Dockers didn't create the casual Friday, but they did recognize this trend, and they saw it as an opportunity, and they promoted it, and they helped shape it. One of the things impeding the initial growth of casual Fridays is that many employers feared that loosening the dress code, even for just one day a week, would lead to all hell breaking loose. Ratty jeans, too short shorts, sleeveless tees. Basically, the bosses were afraid that the office would turn into a Jimmy Buffett concert. So one of the things that Dockers did to promote this trend was to print up an official Guide to Casual Business Wear, which they then mailed out to 25,000 HR directors. The brochure included lists of appropriate and inappropriate attire, as well as tips for accessorizing. There were also lots of pictures of models wearing casual business wear. Coincidentally, and I'm sure this was just a coincidence, the models were mostly wearing Dockers brand clothing and accessories. Now, most of the white-collar workers who would wear Dockers to work once a week likely already owned Dockers for some other use, for golf, for casual dinner parties, for weekend outings with friends. By promoting casual Fridays, Dockers was not introducing their product to an entirely new group of customers. Instead, this was providing their current customer base a new opportunity to buy more of their current product line. Dockers was very clever to identify and successfully exploit a cultural opportunity to sell more of their current products to their current customers. But my favorite example of a market penetration strategy executed to perfection comes from Arm & Hammer baking soda. Baking soda is a commodity product, and historically, it was pretty much just used for baking. Instead of trying to encourage more baking, the brilliant marketers at Arm & Hammer leveraged their product's ability to clean and deodorize and went out and found dozens and dozens of non-baking uses for baking soda. Open a box of Arm & Hammer and leave it in your fridge. Keep things smelling nice. Oh, and when you're at it, put another box in your freezer. And don't forget to swap them out every 3 months. You can also sprinkle it in your laundry to whiten and freshen your clothes. Use it as an all-natural household cleaner. Mix it with paint to absorb those paint fumes. You can even pour some down your drain to freshen and deodorize your sink. A friend of mine, another marketing professor, likes to say that if you have reached the point where you can convince your customers to buy your product, pour it down the drain, and then go out and buy more of your product, you've made it. You have reached the pinnacle of marketing, and there is no more that anyone can teach you. Arm & Hammer used a market penetration strategy by providing an endless list of new reasons to use their product, encouraging people who probably already had baking soda in their pantry to go out and buy more, and then more, and then more. I always encourage my students to start with market penetration when looking for ways to grow their businesses. This is often the lowest hanging fruit. But when you've gotten all you can out of your current customers and your current product line, you may need to look elsewhere for growth. One way to find new sales is with a product development strategy. This is where you try to serve the same group of customers with a new product. The advantage of pursuing a product development course is that you already, presumably, have a solid understanding of your target customers. You are already serving them with some offerings. Now, you use that understanding to serve them through additional products and services. These new offerings don't have to be new to the marketplace, although they can be. Often, they're just new to your company. Many brand extensions are the result of following a product development strategy. Consider the example of Special K. Special K started out as a low-calorie alternative to sugary cold cereals, but Kellogg branched out from there. Now the Special K brand includes meal replacement bars, snack bars, frozen waffles, breakfast sandwiches, diet pastry crisps, and low-calorie brownie bites, breakfast shakes, protein water. I'm not even sure what protein water is, honestly, but Special K would be happy to sell it to you. All of these products are grouped together under the umbrella of helping people, primarily women, manage weight. The Special K brand has moved from serving their customer just by providing a low-calorie cereal to providing a whole host of consumables that would help their customer cut calories and lose weight. This is a product development strategy. The customer stayed the same, but the new products were added to the mix to better serve that same customer. So far, we've looked at market penetration and product development. The third source of growth in the Ansoff matrix is market development. Here we seek out new customers for our current line of products. Like product development, market development is typically more risky than market penetration. After all, you're trying something with a new group of customers that you likely don't know as well as your current customers. But the strength of a market development strategy is that you're not developing a radically new and different product. Market development means selling more or less the same offerings just to a new group of people. Geographic expansion is one of the more common means of market development. By opening a new store or a new office in a different part of the country, you're seeking to sell the same products and services to customers that couldn't buy them before. But you don't need to expand geographically to engage in market development. Often, new customers can be found by resegmenting. New targets may be chosen and then communicated to directly. Sometimes some repositioning of the current offerings will be in order to better serve these new customers. For example, a few lectures ago, I told you the sad story of Levi's failed development of a line of high-end men's suits in the early 1980s. That unfortunate venture was based on their assessment that they had saturated the men's jeans market, and they felt they were selling as many five-pocket Western-style jeans as they were likely to sell. So they concluded if they wanted to grow, they had to look elsewhere. As I already told you, Levi's decided to pursue a diversification strategy, pursuing a new product, high-end suits, for a new group of customers, that fashionable clothes horse, the classic independent. We'll talk more about diversification next. But first we should ask, was there an easier growth strategy they could have used? What about trying to sell their existing product, jeans, to a new and different group of customers? It's hard to remember now, but jeans are not always as ubiquitous as they currently are. I have unfortunate photographic evidence from my own elementary school days that reveals a wide appeal of polyester at that point in time. A lot of polyester and a healthy dose of corduroy. In retrospect, it seems so obvious, but at that time, Levi's was busy burning money in the development of high-end suits, the children, adolescent, and teen markets for casual jeans was largely untapped. Are there any other markets to which Levi's might sell jeans? We've saturated the men's market. Let's see, could there be anyone else aside from men who might wear pants? Anyone at all? Right! Women! I remember them. 50% of the population, right? Yeah, it's coming back to me now. You know, now that I think about it, actually, my mother is a woman. True story. Yes, women. There's hardly any market at all for casual jeans for women in the late 70s and early 80s. Most of the action in women's denim was in the fashion space. Think Jordache. But casual women's jeans, including the eventually to be dreaded mom jeans, that market was just underdeveloped. And the greatest irony is Levi's missed it. It's actually Lee Jeans that is generally credited with having discovered the women's casual jeans market. Levi's was trying so hard to find more exotic sources of growth that they missed the massive, low-risk opportunities they were perfectly positioned to capture. Which brings us to the last of the four ways to grow. In the lower right-hand corner of the matrix is diversification. This is when you try to sell a new product to a new group of customers. This is obviously the riskiest strategy because it involves two entirely new and different sources of uncertainty. Which is not to say diversification is bad or that you should never do it. Clearly, it sometimes is the right move. I do worry, though, that many marketers seem to jump too easily to a diversification strategy when there are other, less risky sources of growth that have not yet been fully exploited. I'm looking at you, Levi's Suits. The upside of diversification is that when done correctly, it can vastly expand a company's reach. Ideally, serving a different group of customers, often in different markets with a diverse set of products, often from different price quality tiers, and sometimes in entirely different categories, this can insulate a company from shocks or changes in any one particular market or product category. A diversified company tends to be a robust company. So let's look at some examples of diversification. One where it was done well, and one where it was done poorly. Marriott Hotels is an example of where diversification has led to a stable of offerings that serve different customers at different price points with different offerings. Toward the lower end of the spectrum, there's Fairfield Inn and Suites by Marriott. That's the full name of the hotel. The Marriott brand name is still attached, though it's smaller and more discreet in the signage and advertising. Fairfield Inns are promoted as everything you need for a comfortable and productive stay at a great value. Certainly not the cheapest hotel you'll find on the market, but a clean, nice, reasonably priced hotel catering mostly to the occasional traveler. A half a step up from the Fairfield is the Courtyard by Marriott. Note that the Marriott brand is still attached. Courtyard is promoted as specifically designed to accommodate frequent travelers. Convenience and service set it apart, at a somewhat higher price. Marriott hotels are more expensive still. The flagship hotel chain seeks to celebrate the travelers of the world and to make every stay and event unforgettable and effortless. AC Hotels by Marriott aims to be more exclusive, offering a lifestyle hotel, stylish, cosmopolitan, and urban for the design-conscious traveler. And at the top, we have JW Marriott Resorts. These very expensive hotels offer top-of-the-line accommodations for vacationers. Marriott is the end result of pursuing a diversification strategy. Each hotel is distinctly positioned from the others to try to serve a different group of customers. But diversification can also go poorly when you're not careful. We saw one example with Levi's trying to go after a more discerning customer with an upscale offering. Let me give you another example. This time, the brand was Cadillac, and they chose to diversify by pursuing a less wealthy customer segment and offering a downscale extension. Now, there was a time when Cadillac ruled the road. It was one of the finest automobiles money could buy. Cadillac even became an idiom. We refer to something as a Cadillac if it is the best, the most prestigious, the most luxurious exemplar in its category. For most people, unfortunately, the shine has long since worn off the Cadillac brand. So, how did a brand as bulletproof as Cadillac go into such steep decline? Well, there are a number of reasons, but a big one happened in 1986. Up until that point, Cadillac had been an exclusively luxury brand. They only sold expensive, high-status cars. But that will always, by definition, be a small market. A lucrative one, but small. Elvis could only buy so many Cadillacs. So, Cadillac decided to trade on some of their luxury brand image by introducing an everyman's Cadillac. They introduced the Cimarron as a downscale brand extension, a lower quality, lower priced Cadillac that a much larger slice of the population could afford to buy. Now, you might be saying to yourself, is this really a new product for them? After all, Cadillac had been making cars for a long time. Wasn't this just another car targeting a new group of customers? So more of a market development strategy. Sure, a case can be made for that. But I think the Cimarron was sufficiently different from the high-end luxury cars that Cadillac was making that it's better thought of as a diversification move, both a new product and a new group of customers. The fact was, Cadillac didn't have any expertise in making and selling affordable cars. And they didn't even try to develop any. They just took another car from GM's line, the Chevy Cavalier, added a few features, slapped some Cadillac emblems on it. Oh, and then they expected people to pay about twice as much for it. How well did that work out for them? Yeah, not so well. First-year sales were only about a third of what they had projected. And even though sales were weak, the fact that these small, unstylish, moderate-quality cars were out there on the road at all and would stay on the road for years after they were purchased did immediate and lasting damage to Cadillac's brand. The people at Cadillac were so traumatized by the failed diversification strategy that for years afterwards, Cadillac's product director, John Howell, had a picture of the Cimarron on his wall with a caption, "Lest we forget." So that's the Ansoff matrix. Remember that there are several potential sources for growth. There's nothing inherently wrong with the riskiest strategy, diversification, but you should recognize that it is risky and plan accordingly. In the last part of the lecture, I want to think about sourcing new sales from a slightly different perspective. And I want to give you another tool to add to your marketing toolbox. This is known as a gap analysis, and it's used to diagnose the source of a sales failure. In other words, if you have a product or service on the market that you think should be selling, but it's not, you perform a gap analysis to figure out why. We're going to do two versions of a gap analysis. First, let's look at using a gap analysis to manage adoption, that is, first-time sales. The way this analysis works is you start with the largest group of potential customers, in this case, your entire target segment. You then conduct market research to work through a series of potential impediments to sales and figure out where the biggest drop-offs are occurring. These are your gaps, and these tend to be where it's most worthwhile to address your efforts. The first possible impediment to adoption is awareness. Of your potential customers, what percentage are simply not aware that your offering exists? If you were to visualize this as a bar graph, that first bar would represent everyone, so 100% of your target. Next, you would see awareness, which would have to be some number less than 100%. Not everyone in your target market is aware of your offering. So there'll be some gap between the total market and the group that is aware. If you're marketing Coke or McDonald's, that gap will be very small. Almost everyone is already aware of your product. If you're launching a new product, on the other hand, that gap could be quite large, indicating that you should place your efforts on increasing awareness, for example, by advertising in mass media. But awareness is not the only impediment to sales. Understanding is another. It could be that your people know your product exists, but they don't know what it is or what it does. In another lecture, we saw how TiVo faced this problem. As the first to market with a radically new technology, they made the mistake of trying to tell people everything that was great about it all at once. They ended up overwhelming and confusing people. For a period of time, lots of people were aware of TiVo, but a much smaller portion understood what it was. Or it could be that people are aware of your product and understand it, they just don't find it very attractive, either because they don't sufficiently appreciate the benefits or because they think the costs are too high. Segway is my example of a product that had a gap between understanding and attractiveness. When it launched, Segway scooters had perhaps more free press than any new product introduced up to that point. Pages and pages of ink were printed about this product back when it was codenamed Ginger, back before we even knew what it was. By the time it launched, Segway had benefited from very high levels of awareness. Likewise, it was such a technological oddity that soon after launch, people were inundated with explanations of what it was and how it worked. Gyroscopes, self-balancing. Unfortunately for the good people at Segway, people just didn't find it that attractive. In many municipalities, it's illegal to drive one on the sidewalk and insane to try to drive one on the road. It's also very expensive. So basically, unless you're an airport cop, this thing is just not going to work for you. So no one bought it. Or it could be people are aware of your offering. They understand it. They find it attractive. They simply can't afford it. Lots of people would love a Bentley, but not many can afford to buy one. Or affordability might not be the problem. It could be availability. Every Christmas, we get a different example of this impediment. Some toy becomes inexplicably hot, supply cannot meet demand, and desperate parents get into fistfights in frustration over not being able to acquire that particular toy. And little Susie's Christmas and subsequently her entire life are ruined forever. A less dramatic example can occur when your offering is only available in certain retailers or in certain regions. The last impediment to possible sales is purchase intent. You may have made me aware of your product. I might understand it and love it. It fits within my budget and I know where to get it, but it's just not something that I buy very often. The good people at Viking may have convinced me that their gas ranges are absolutely the best thing ever and the one thing I need to complete my life. But until I decide to renovate my kitchen, they're just going to have to wait before getting my money. Those are the impediments to adoption that you can run through in trying to figure out what is holding back your sales. A gap analysis is an important exercise to do because each of these impediments requires a different solution. If people aren't buying your offering because they can't find it on the shelves, then advertising more isn't going to solve the problem. You need to talk to the folks in operations. Likewise, an ad campaign designed to promote awareness is going to be very different from a campaign designed to foster understanding. Find the gap before proceeding with the strategy. Another way to use a gap analysis is to examine repurchase. For many products, success is not measured simply by the number of people who buy the product for the first time. Very often, success or failure depends on how many customers continue to buy it. For this kind of gap analysis, we start with purchase. In other words, the largest possible category is people who have bought at least once. We then look at impediments to repeat purchasing. The first of which is satisfaction. It could be that people don't buy the product simply because, once they've tried it, they just don't like it. During the low-carb craze in the late 1990s, many ice cream manufacturers came out with low-carb versions of their products. And because low-carb was very popular at the time, lots of people bought these low-carb ice creams. Once. But they never went back because low-carb ice cream is terrible. So, if you're running into a problem with sales, that's the first thing to check. Are your target customers actually satisfied with the offering when they try it? The second potential impediment to consider is usage frequency. How often do they use the product? In the 1980s, Grey Poupon ran an iconic ad for their Dijon mustard featuring one man in a Rolls Royce asking another man in a Rolls Royce if he had any Grey Poupon. But of course, it was a great commercial, and it made Grey Poupon a very popular condiment. People bought it, they liked it, and then they stuck it in their refrigerator, where it stayed for years. Grey Poupon had successfully positioned itself as the mustard you use only for very special occasions. And honestly, how many very special occasions require fancy mustard? So people didn't use it. Usage frequency was the problem. A similar potential impediment to repurchase comes in the form of usage quantity. Usage frequency is how often you use the product. Usage quantity is how much of the product you use each time you use it. How much shampoo do you use per lathering? How much detergent per wash? How much dressing per salad? Companies sometimes try to influence usage quantity by changing the mouth size on bottles or the viscosity of liquids. Finally, just as there can be an impediment to purchase caused by purchase intent, so there can be an impediment to repurchase caused by repurchase intent. Maybe people want to buy your product, they just can't seem to remember when they go to the store. The host of internet-powered subscription services, including Dollar Shave Club and Diapers.com, aim to overcome this impediment by mailing out replacements for commonly used items on a preset schedule. Okay, in this lecture, we talked about the four sources of new sales, as laid out in the Ansoff matrix. We also talked about the gap analysis as a strategic tool you can use to diagnose sales problems. But sales are just one source of value companies can get from customers, namely monetary value, or dollars coming in the door. In the next lecture, we'll continue our discussion by looking at some of the other sources of value companies can get out of a transaction.
This lecture is titled Deriving Value from Your Customers.
In the first lecture, we defined marketing in terms of creating value for all the parties involved in an exchange. This means both the customer and the company must get something out of an exchange in order for it to be considered a success. Some companies make very expansive claims about always doing what's best for the customer, regardless of the cost. But the reality is the customer's value can't be the only thing you consider. You still need to find a way to keep the lights on. Likewise, some people believe cynically that marketing is all about bilking the customer, extracting the maximum value from those suckers at every exchange. And this is fine if you're Professor Harold Hill and your business is selling boys' bands across rural Iowa. But it's not a viable long-term business strategy for most businesses. The best marketing happens when everybody walks away feeling like they've won. Just as there are several sources of value for the customers, as we've already talked about, there are also several potential sources of value for companies as well. In the last lecture, we talked about the direct value customers can provide to companies in the form of sales. In this lecture, I'd like to encourage you to think more broadly about the sources of value a company should seek. In particular, we'll cover three additional kinds of value that customers can create for companies: loyalty value, information value, and communication value. Let's start with loyalty value. Customer loyalty is seen by some as kind of a snake oil for marketing. Loyal customers are widely considered to cost less to serve and to be less price sensitive. They also tend to buy more and buy more often. What's not to love? But how do you identify loyal customers and promote customer loyalty? One mistake people sometimes make is operationalizing loyalty in purely behavioral terms. So you might consider a customer to be loyal if he or she has bought more than a certain amount of your product within a certain time frame. Or you might look at the people who buy an especially high proportion of one brand relative to others in a particular category. And to be sure, you might generally expect loyal customers to buy more of your offering. Sure. But frequency, volume, and share of purchase are not necessarily evidence of loyalty. It could be that someone buys from you out of habit. Behaviorally, this would look a lot like loyalty. After all, they're both buying your offerings, but psychologically, they're really very different. Habit is a behavioral response to a certain cue or stimulus. When the cue is present, we feel an urge to act in response. In the normal course of events, habit and loyalty might look the same, but if something changes to interrupt the cue, a store rearranges its shelves, or the customer moves to a new city where they face an entirely different set of environmental cues, well, then the habitual behavior will never get triggered. Or if people are shocked out of their reverie and given a reason to re-examine their behaviors, they might choose to break their habits. There are other differences too. Habitual buyers are less likely to tell friends about your brand, for example. Loyalty is also more robust than habit. It's rooted in feelings that this offering is somehow superior to other offerings available out there. People aren't just buying it because they've always bought it. They're buying it because they really like it, because they think it's theirs. And that can make a huge difference. For those companies that are really interested in fostering loyalty among their customers, using behavioral indicators may not be the best place to start. If you spend time with individual customers, observing them, listening to them talk about brands at length, you will find that customers use different language in discussing the brands that they are loyal to. Loyal customers talk about brands as relationship partners. Now, these people are not crazy. They don't think of brands as actual people or anything. But people can and do form relationships of a sort with non-people, whether it's a pet or the house you grew up in or a brand that you've used for a long time. The nature of these relationships is important because they affect how customers think about their exchanges with the company. The anthropologist Alan Fiske noted that people form different kinds of relationships with people, and that these different relationships color the way they engage in economic transactions. To get a feel for the types of distinctions Fiske was making, imagine you're selling a car. First, imagine you're selling your car to a salesperson at a used car dealership. Fiske would characterize your relationship with the salesperson as a market pricing relationship. The exchange you engage in with this person would be based on a clear-headed reckoning of the dollar value of the car, and both you and the salesperson would seek to maximize your outcome in the exchange. In this sense, the exchange is competitive. Now, imagine instead you are selling your car to your younger brother. Would you push as hard to get the highest price you possibly could? Or would you be more interested in making sure your brother could comfortably afford what he was buying? What if the car broke down the day after you sold it? Would you feel any obligation to your brother to pitch in for the repairs? Or maybe even take the car back? Would you feel the same obligation to the used car dealership if the car broke down the day after you sold it to him? Fiske would characterize the relationship you have with those closest to you as a communal sharing relationship. These relationships are characterized by a desire to maximize fairness, by give and take, and shared values. Exchanges within these relationships are not about maximizing individual value, but instead about treating others equitably. What does this have to do with customer loyalty? Well, because the types of relationships people form with others have parallels in the relationships people form with brands and with companies. Many of the relationships we have with brands are market exchange relationships. We recognize that the company is an entity out to maximize its utility, and we enter the exchange seeking the same. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But some exchanges we engage in are with companies or brands that we have more of a communal relationship with. I know that sounds crazy, but it's true. Don't believe me? Think about someone who's religious about their Macintosh. They have an Apple logo on their car. They own multiple Apple products, possibly using several of them simultaneously throughout the day. Now think about the last time that person experienced a problem with their Mac. Maybe it crashed and they lost some data, or it froze up during a presentation. How did that person react? If he or she is anything like the Mac people I know, they probably used some excuse for the computer rather than blame Apple. Where someone with a market pricing relationship with the Apple brand would expect the product to work properly and lay any brand failures on the brand itself, those with a communal sharing relationship want to make sure the brand is treated fairly. They want to give Apple the benefit of the doubt. Better to blame the computer freezing up on that Microsoft Office software that they installed. That's probably what's really causing the problem. With that in mind, I want you to think about what passes for loyalty programs at many companies. These programs incentivize repeated purchases, and many are very successful at doing so. But are they really generating loyalty? Are they changing the nature of the relationship that people have with this brand? Would people continue to buy if the loyalty rewards were taken away? Now,